Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors.
Hello, and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Hey guys, Dr. Santosh here, pediatric infectious disease doc and researcher.
Santosh, I'm having a very relaxing week. I swung by the library, checked out a few new books. One of them got me thinking about you because did you know that there are bacterial libraries?
Well, not really like libraries, as it like nobody wants you to return the bacteria when you check it out.
Can I have a cup of tuberculosis?
Just a little cup of tuberculosis and then we'll send it back. But yeah, we have for researchers and then also for clinical laboratories, we have what's called reference strains. And these are big stores of things. It's kind of like I think we might have talked about the seed vault in Svalbard, but this isn't for like a doomsday situation. This is if you need a particular strain of bacteria or something, we can like lend it out to you.
To be fair, it is more likely to initiate a doomsday situation.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
And despite that, in the same article I was reading, I found out that this bacterial library has an artist in residence.
All right, so this might be okay. This is in the vein of people who like draw the beautiful, kind of renditions of what they see through the microscope.
Put that pen and paper down. This is by Anna Dumitriou, who became the first artist in residence in 2018. We will link to her work in the show notes, and in anticipation. Ooh, okay. Of the collection's 100th anniversary, that's the centennial, right? In anticipation of the collection's centennial, she created the raw silk plague dress filled with killed, this is important, killed Yersinia pestis bacteria.
Yeah, that is very, very important. You kill the Yersinia pestis first and kill it like dead.
I mean, I don't know that I'd want to wear clothing that is loaded with bacteria, dead or otherwise, but I also wear scrubs, so never mind.
No, there you go. Yeah, sure.
But I figured since we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of these libraries and I found out they existed a lot less than 100 years ago, that it might be nice to review them and kind of go over you know, how they got here, how they were founded. And it sounds like you have some familiarity with at least one, right?
Believe it or not, this was one of those things where I hadn't really looked up what the acronym stood for until you wrote it down here. But ATCC is the main company as a researcher in microbiology. If you need a reference strain of something, whether it's a bacteria or a fungus, in my case, in parasitology, if you need a specific strain of toxoplasma, or actually in cell biology as well, if you need a particular cell line, this is one of these companies that is actually for profit rather than being a library type, where they will get you whatever you need. They have a screening process so that they can make sure that, for instance, if it's a cell line, that it's pathogen free and that it's ready to, you know, kind of be a standard for your experiment on, ship it to you at, you know, dry ice kind of thing. And then boom, you have a cell culture or a bacterial culture or whatever you need kind of ready to go. And yeah, they have a full-on catalog on the website. It's like the Best Buy of cell biology.
I was about to say, in an abbreviated version, it sounds like the Amazon Prime of disease delivery.
Yeah, and actually, you can you can be Prime too. You can be a particular kind of member. And of course, you know, your institution should have a specific account with them so that you can order.
Before we get to your modern day Prime membership, I'll take you back to the winter of 1915. Private Ernest Cable arrived at the number 14 station hospital in France.
Okay.
Wimereux, France. Nope. Why? Weimarux?
I actually don't know exactly how to, but that R-E-U-X is like Rue, like, you know, almost like saying R-O-O. So it's probably Wimereux.
France. Yeah? In bad shape.
Uh-huh. Okay, got it.
Private Cable had Shigella Flexneri, military bacteriologist named Lieutenant William Broughton Alcock, took a sample of Flexneri from Private Cable's sadly deceased body.
For everybody who doesn't know off the top of your head, Shigella is one of the causes of bloody diarrhea or dysentery.
Listen to our Oregon Trail episode for more. The sample that Lieutenant Alcock took was sent off to become the very first, or NCTC1, first specimen added to Britain's National Collection of Type Cultures. And Britain has the oldest library of human bacterial pathogens in the world devoted to sharing strains with other scientists. So that's the one that's turning 100. So,
oh, cool.
It holds about 6,000 bacterial strains, and that represents over 900 different species that can infect, sicken, maim, and kill us. And strains may just be genetic variants of a species. So, you know, E. coli volumes 1 through 300. And, yeah. You know, big wet Shigella.
And oftentimes there is an initialism that's attached to them because of where they're from, or maybe the person who donated the organism, well, or that it was taken from. And it usually has a year attached to it also. So, you know, it'll have a 19 or a 20. Oh, it's from 2019 or 2020, something like that.
Mm,
so it'll
have Victorian tuberculosis, a very good year.
It'll have the, so there are quite a few of these, Josh, where we like to use a standardized strain that isn't altered over a period of time to say that, like, if one person is experimenting with this type of E. coli, that it can be replicated somewhere else in another lab with exactly the same strain. And that way you eliminate one extra variable when you're running those experiments. So like, oh, you know, there could be tiny genetic differences that are throwing your experiments off. Or you could actually start to learn about what strain differences matter with things like virulence or antibiotic resistance.
Of the 800 different culture collections in 78 countries, The NCTC is one of only a few dedicated to clinically relevant bacteria, so species that make us sick. So as you mentioned, there's a whole bunch of different groups. One may be UC Davis's collection of wine microbes, important to the culinary world.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. So those are microbes that have been used in fermentation to make good wine. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's also the culture collection of microorganisms from extreme environments, which sounds like a political action committee.
Yeah, these are ones which have been sampled, for instance, at great ocean depths from geothermal vents. So they are, you know, basically sitting at like 400 degrees Celsius, but they're still living, just feeding off the acidic rock somehow.
Or how about the molecules?
That one, I've never heard of a molecule. What's a molecule?
Oh, I thought you were going to... It's a class of bacteria distinguished by the complete absence of a cell wall.
Okay, so probably like mycoplasma? I'm not sure.
Yeah, they typically have a very small genome size, but they sound adorable, don't they?
Yeah. See, we're not very good at naming things, but every now and again, it's just like, oh, molecule.
So it's got its own little fan club. But most of these are, again, not clinically relevant bacteria. So that's why having some of these disease libraries is so important. Some of these behaviors they have include studying how bacteria evolve, testing safety protocols, developing vaccines, and anti-cancer drugs and treatments. So, Santosh, what kind of things does a disease library do? And do all disease libraries do them, or just, you know, the ATCC you mentioned?
So ATCC is around, they have kind of a dual purpose. Yes, they catalog all of these different culture types, whether they are, and you've been mentioning pathogens and bacteria, fungi, parasites so far. They also have a separate category, which is like cell lines. So we talked a little while ago, I think maybe two episodes ago, about HeLa, which are the immortalized cells from this cancer, from Henrietta Lacks. They are one of the companies that have propagated that cell line and then keep it, you know, frozen so that they have a stock of those cells that they can send out when people need to purchase these, when they need to have them in the laboratory to establish their own cell lines in the lab. So you actually have kind of dual purposes. You can have the cells, which are not necessarily like pathogenic, you know, infections, that kind of a thing. And then you have bacteria, fungi, I don't think viruses as far as ATCC, but I can double check, and parasites. But from my standpoint, what we mainly use them for was if I wanted to run a particular experiment and I wanted to eliminate the variable of, you know, is this particular parasite acting this way because of like minute genetic differences between strains, then I can go back to ATCC and I can go back to a reference strain. And Josh, it can be, you know, what exactly like you're saying, like 100 years old, but it has been grown up and then frozen down at minus 80 degrees. So it's kind of stuck in time. And I can go back and I can say, oh, you know, this is why this particular parasite is acting this way in response to whatever I do to it. And then I can also, you know, I can propagate that strain through cell culture, or I can manipulate it in a different way. And I can study separately, oh, you know, there are these genetic differences that I can look at to explain why the behavior changes or why the phenotype changes of how it metabolizes certain sugars or fats or whatever it is, or maybe how virulent it is, or if it developed resistance, oh, what's the differences between these two strains? What are the genes that gave it this antimicrobial resistance? So that is really the power of having a reference strain that you can kind of set a standard. The easiest way I think I can explain it to someone who doesn't do biology, right, is just to say, well, how do you know that an inch on your ruler is an inch? Well, there is a standards and measures that, you know, established, oh, this is an inch or this is a centimeter.
There's an entire U.S. department dedicated to it.
Yeah, and in fact, there's one in France, and there's, you know, there's a centralized thing. And so this is the same kind of thing where you can say, oh, I can actually just set a standard for, you know, this is the reference strain that we're working with. And now we can take a look at what are the differences and similarities between strains. Yeah, it's really, really cool to be able to have that.
It's like checking out the Encyclopedia Bacterianica.
It kind of, yeah, because you have at least as much control as you can possibly muster and say, okay, this is at least unchanged in standard. It's happened, by the way, to a lot of us in research where we've run the exact same experiment on what we think is the exact same parasite, and then we get completely divergent results. And when we go back and we say, oh, which strain did you use? Oh, I used this strain instead of this strain. And it leads to some pretty cool, interesting results when we communicate with one another. In this day and age, Josh, when we have so much easy communication and you can not only get a reference strain, but you can feed into the library, meaning like you can donate a strain and put it in. It's so cool how we can exchange that knowledge really, really quickly and, you know, learn what we need to learn in either molecular biology or cell biology or biochemistry. So we've got this beautiful library. And nowadays, Josh, in the age of genetics and molecular tools, we in kind of addition, if you just want one piece of the genome, like you don't want the whole bacteria, but you need a specific, you know, a chunk like a plasmid, you can also have a plasmid library.
Well, we'll talk about the ATCC supervillain wing a little bit later in the episode.
We can. Okay. By the way, everybody who's listening and you're thinking like, oh, I can Amazon Prime my own bacteria and all this kind
you
of
definitely thing. Cannot. Just,
yeah, you definitely cannot. You have to have an institutional kind of reference and login. And before they send you absolutely anything, they follow you know, the same national and international rules that we all do.
Let's come back to that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we'll come back to that.
You know, we'll talk about checking out a book or a bacteria later.
Sure.
So the very first collection, you know, of which included poor private Cables, poor Ernest Cables, Shigella Flexneri.
Dysentery. Yeah, his poop.
Along with 200 other cultures, so 99 problems, and dysentery was one.
Yes.
were deposited by Sir Frederick William Andrews, a pathologist whose hobby was, surprise, surprise, dysentery all through World War I.
Well, you say it like it's, you know, something he did on his side. This was his research focus.
This was his dream, his day-to-day. You don't go into this unless you have a passion for it. So,
yeah, that's true.
Once he opened it at the Lister Institute of Preventative Medicine in 1920, they basically put out an ad in the paper asking the scientific community, saying, hey, we're trying to build up this standard of diseases, this reference of diseases, this appendix of infections that you mentioned earlier. And the organization received it in bulk, and they sent over 2,000 strains to various institutions for free over the next year. I mean, requested. It's not like they're just, what should we give out for Christmas this year? How about anthrax, right? Everybody loves anthrax. So,
yeah. Yeah. And this was in an age before all of the safety standards. And it was also in kind of the age that, like, you didn't really order this unless you were already kind of in the know. You know, we weren't in that kind of age of information where we are.
The bacteria were delivered alive on a medium of agar-agar made from Dorset egg yolks and sealed in paraffin wax.
Still used today, paraffin film, or we call it parafilm.
Now, this collection, again, still around 200, was transferred to a farmhouse north of London in 1939, which is very lucky, as the institute was then bombed repeatedly during World War II. So, Lister Institute did not prevent, preventative medicine may have been a bit optimistic.
Yeah.
The curator then began loaning the collection out to medical and veterinary strains, and unfortunately, as they lost their major home, they had to start charging scientists 2.06 shillings per strain. So about $5 in today's money.
Yeah. I there was a wonderful time where you could just charge where whatever you needed to, and you could be kind of charitable with this kind of a thing. But I do understand that in the modern day and age, that if you want to turn something like this into a business and actually make a profit margin on it, then it's no longer 2 shillings.
So thanks to charging these late fees, interest, whatever, this gonorrhea GoFundMe was able to move back to London.
I don't know if they got gonorrhea yet. Sure.
And has become a nonprofit. Fine, chlamydia Kickstarter.
Why are you hung up on STIs? Sure, fine. Yeah, chlamydia Kickstarter sounds great.
Anthrax Amazon? I mean,
Anthrax Amazon's pretty good. I like that.
But today it's a nonprofit that self-supports through the sale of strains. Oh, try saying that 10 times fast.
Ooh, tularemia targets.
Which usually... Oh, nice.
Wolbachia Walmart. Sorry. Okay, I'm done. That's the last one.
Leprosy Lowe's.
Yes.
Histoplasma Home Depot. Anyway, most of the strains today cost anywhere between $85 to $375 US, which kind of begs the question, like, what makes a strain desirable? They're like, ugh, give me top shelf tuberculosis. I don't want any of this.
Yeah. So this has to do with a bunch of parameters on how
dime
much.
Wait. Well, I got one more.
Oh, yeah.
Dime store. Go. Dime store Diplococcus. Okay. Now proceed.
I like which wonderfully encompasses your gonorrhea in that, as Neisseria is a Diplococcus. So you have to take into account how much it took to originally acquire the strain and then transport it into wherever the library is, and then the storage conditions you need to put it under. Most of these are going to be stored in liquid nitrogen, or, you know, at minus 80 in a deep freeze. But in order to actually take them out of freeze and, you know, get them onto media, or actually like harvest a vial, thaw it out, you know, recover some of the bacteria and then freeze it back to send to whoever has requested it, it takes, you know, quite a bit of technical skill in order to do that for tuberculosis, for instance, where you have to keep very, very safe so that that mycobacteria doesn't get out of the vial and give everybody tuberculosis, versus something like you know, your garden variety E. coli's, which, yes, you know, some of them are pathogenic, some of them are not, but, you know, you really can't get sick from them unless you, like, go ahead and, like, tip the vial back and take a drink. So preparation for those is much less so. But honestly, Josh, there are others where there's very little of a given sample remaining, and whether it's a type of bacteria or a cell line, it is precious and it is actually fragile, meaning that, like, just to handle it and stuff, you can kill it to bring it out of thaw, and then transportation costs and all these other things, because a lot of the time there's a shared cost when you have to pay, like, postage and government to handle biohazardous packages. And you're going to pay whoever's shipping to do that. So all those kind of go into the cost of whatever you're going to order. And that's how you make it so that, like, you know, it's like a whatever, like, super expensive, rare Pokemon versus, like, a, you know, a common.
Well, they do hold a lot of bacteria relevant to medical breakthroughs. And as we mentioned, as they date back to 1920, some celebrities have left their own deposits. Oh, that sounds so dirty.
No. Well, you know, as a for instance, you know, if you have a viral library, right? So Tom Hanks caught COVID.
I was about to say, not helping.
No.
Tom Hanks' viral library sounds like, well, that sounds like a movie I would watch.
The Viral Library, starring Tom Hanks. Yeah.
So, like, absolutely. Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin, deposited 16 strains into the collection between 1928 and 1948. So as he was doing his experiments, be like, oh, hey, this is pretty neat. And he would, you know, package it up in egg yolks and paraffin and send it off to the NCTC.
Not really egg yolks. The media is prepared from egg, but it's not like, yeah.
Said Dorset egg yolks. I'm assuming it's like some kind of, you know, omelet. But okay. One of the bacteria that he did, Haemophilus influenza, he sourced from his own nose.
And we can actually all pretty much do that. We have non-typable Haemophilus growing in our nose.
We're not supposed to source stuff from our own nose anymore, Santosh.
No, we're not. We're not. Because it is a strain variation which can cause aberrations in your model experiment.
So I... Now that
packaging these things today.
Now that I know what kind of person is dropping stuff off at the library, Alexander Fleming and you. Yeah. I also wanted to know.
Is Alexander Fleming? There's a million bugs I haven't stung. Just you.
As of 2019. The collection had sent over 3,800 ampules of bacteria to 63 different countries. So that left a lot of statistics. And I wanted to know what were some of the most requested, or, you know, what were the hot Pokemon? So top sellers, Clostridium, you know, a leading cause of infectious diarrhea. So C. difficile, E. coli, 360 different strains to choose from. That's more than Baskin Robbins, folks.
Yeah, and some of these are natural strains, and some of them are actually genetically engineered to be able to perform specific microbial factory type of things, so that you've kind of manipulated them to do exactly what you need in a particular time.
Staphylococcus, everybody's favorite bacteria. Several kinds of mycobacteria, things like tuberculosis, mostly tuberculosis, and leprosy, and salmonella from contaminated food. Now, these are all shipped from a distribution center outside of London. They certainly don't want it in a big urban center, and it's under strict protocols with biosafety level 4, which is the absolute deadliest. Most bacteria are biosafety level 2 or 3, which means they can cause serious or lethal disease but have a cure. Level 4 has no known treatments.
Yeah, so Ebola is a good example of a BSL-4. Just like you said, Josh, it's very deadly and very contagious, and it doesn't have a cure, but the mechanism of how it can move around is really scary, because you just touch a little, or if it gets aerosolized somehow, you know, and gets into your mucous membranes, that's it. You know, you've contracted it. So that's the kind of organism where in order to handle it, you're in the full suit, right? Where you have the back of the suit that's actually tethered to a separate breathing source. It's piped kind of outside. And then when you step into the facility, there's like airlocks, so that, you know, the thing cannot get out, and you have negative pressure so that, you know, an errant breeze or something can't carry it outside, like a heavy, heavy duty kind of vault. Yeah.
So those are the ones they're sending out. Now, again, they still receive donations from around the world. So I'm like, what kind of people are donating besides you and Alexander Fleming? Well, some are the kinds that we mentioned, which are newly discovered type strains. So they just want, hey, here's something to add to the encyclopedia. Others are deposited from historical collections, you know, as backups, or by scientists who are retiring or shifting their research and want their strains to have a future. This is the equivalent of a bacterial bar mitzvah for a retiring scientist.
Or a garage sale. You can think of it like, you know, like when you take your stuff down to Goodwill or something like that. It's like, hey, you want any of these? I don't want them anymore.
So what kind of safety protocols? Well, at the National Collection of Type Cultures, the NCTC, All new specimens are cultured on agar to make sure they're alive and uncontaminated, suspended in a sugar-rich cryoprotectant broth, so, you know, like Fruit Loops milk.
It's actually quite goopy. Yeah, it's like syrup.
Fruit Loops milk.
No, like syrup.
Oh.
Or like honey.
Freeze-dried at minus 28 Fahrenheit for 3 to 4 hours, then stuffed with sterilized cotton, flame-sealed in an evacuated of air glass ampoule, and then stored at 39 degrees. And all that is still more stable than the current Pfizer vaccine, which is why there were those issues with transport and the supply chain.
Which, to be very fair, they were taking a lot of precautions with the Pfizer vaccine because they didn't know. And after it got, you know, the marketing was done, it actually came out and everything, we actually learned that it lasts a lot longer than we originally thought at room temperature. So, to be fair, they were overkilling on it.
The process that was described for all the new recipients to the library is pretty much unchanged since the 1930s. And each sample is listed with a description of its origin, identification, special powers, what kind of Pokemon it likes to battle against, and all of that goes into a searchable database. Does anyone get turned away? At least for the most part in London, no. They accept about 90% of the samples they receive, and most of the ones they get are strains that are currently circulating, responsible for new outbreaks or have new antimicrobial resistance profiles. So I guess you could send them your own locally sourced nasal viruses, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, you have to give them a heads up that it's coming. Of course, well, you've got to contact them.
Of course it's a heads up. It's from my nose.
Aha! You have to inform them that you're sending something over, and then you do have to be...
I picked you to receive gift. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
The important thing in terms of transporting it, though, is that you do have to have a lot of licenses and certifications in place that you can handle these, that you can package them, and that you can ship them. And then you have to have the right kind of protocols, even for stuff like labeling and things like that, in order to put it into the box. Like, they don't have a drop-off slot at NTC. You do have to send it over. And likewise, just as you need all those permits in place, there are certain shipping companies that have those protocols and those licenses also that are usually granted by the government that say, oh, okay, I know how to handle these and get them from point A to point B without ruining it. The big reason, Josh, why they accept about 90% of what's sent over is, and this doesn't give our listeners license to go all crazy like that, but they are able to receive and keep about 90% of them because the people who send them are knowledgeable and they know what they're doing. There aren't a lot of like weirdos just like randomly sending stuff.
Although put into historical context, Alexander Fleming got a government permit to pick his nose.
The government permit was to, after he picked his nose, to be able to put it in a box and then send it. They can't tell you how to pick your nose. They can tell you what you can and can't do with
fine.
It.
Fine. He got government funding to pick his nose.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
Don't go exploring up there without the right permits. That's the takeaway lesson.
With a little mining helmet. And it's like, hold it. You have the proper permits. All right, move
on. So the national type, the National Collection of Culture, the NCTC, publicly funded by the government. Yep. Over in the U.S., we run things a little bit differently. Now, our group, as you mentioned earlier, Santosh, is called the ATCC, or American Type Culture Collection. It sounds so highbrow.
It does. And the big difference, which we're about to talk about really, is that there is government oversight in this particular laboratory or this library, but it is a privately funded for-profit company.
Exactly. So it was established originally in 1925 to serve as a national center for depositing and distributing microbiological specimens. So very similar in origin and mission to the NCTC. It is now distributing to over 150 countries. And yes, while the early years were spent at the McCormick Institute in Chicago, they have moved to Georgetown University in DC in 1937. And then as research in bioscience expanded, they began to diversify and now proceeded to hop to a bunch of sites. For the moment, they're at Manassas, Virginia, and that's where they've been since 1998. It is the largest culture collection in the world, with over 3,000 human and animal cell lines, 18,000 mm-hmm. strains of bacteria, 3,000 animal viruses, 1,000 plant viruses, as well as, you know, hobby-sized collections of protozoans, yeasts, and fungi, with over 7,500 different species, and 1,000 strains of protists, and 1,200 mm-hmm. hybridomas. I had to look up what some of those things were.
Yeah. hybridomas are really cool. So you essentially, what you're trying to do is you're trying to make a monoclonal antibody, right? You're trying to make a very, very particular type of antibody. So you actually go through a B cell. The B cell is the type of white blood cell that produces antibodies in large amounts. And you track it one by one to make sure you have the antibody that you want. And this is super important, right? So making monoclonal antibodies help us insanely with all types of assays in order to just even make sure you know what you're looking at. So we use it with immunofluorescence, and we use it on ELISAs, all these different kinds of things. So what you do then is that once you have a B cell that's making the type of antibody that you want, you merge it with an immortalized cell, usually a cancer cell of some type. And that kind of chimeric cell, which now makes antibodies and cannot die, it forms a little tumor. And so you call it a hybridoma, a hybrid tumor. So
okay,
that's a hybridoma.
What's a protist?
Oh, protist is a it's a yeast-like parasite. It's not in the family of fungi, but it's a prokaryotic parasite.
So the ATCC, while they originally began also giving out, well, free samples. So while they began offering, for lack of a better word, free samples, the demand quickly began to outpace the production or supply and maintenance, and they had to start charging, similar to the NCTC, but in mm-hmm. true American fashion, also began some enterprising side hustles, allowing individuals and groups to utilize them as a safe deposit service for their own cell cultures, kind of like, you know, a private whiskey cabinet, providing a secure backup for valuable biomaterials if required. The ATCC also is able to retain secure samples of patented materials, such as drugs, and distribute them according to instructions and approval of the patent holder. So that's something that can come in handy, say, during a national emergency.
Usually it's in very small amounts so that someone can at least take it and have it as a blueprint. And then if they need to make more of it, they can produce it after studying the molecule.
They also provide biological repository services to institutions, agencies, and companies who want to outsource their own culture collections. And in a way that I'm sure will not cause any conflicts of interest down the line, they also make all the rules that determines who can do this and under what conditions in the US, setting standards for reagent and assay quality, which are used by the Food and Drug Administration, the WHO, and a whole host of other government departments.
Yeah, so we are putting a massive amount of faith in this company. And by the way, in this singular company, because there really isn't a lot of competition in this space, Josh. There's a little bit. There are small companies here and there in biotech that'll have like cell lines and things like that. But ATCC is an absolute behemoth. Thankfully, so far, there has not been any abuse of this. It is by and large run by scientists. So, you know, PhDs that have, you know, earned their kind of their stripes in academia and then gone on to work at ATCC. And so there has been a pretty good standard of scientific integrity there.
Don't beat that drum too loudly just yet, Santosh.
Oh no, you're gonna pull the rug out from under me, aren't you?
Well, the ATCC, along with the Center for Disease Control and the knowledge and approval of the Departments of Commerce and Defense.
Sure, sure.
Always a good start when you have to lead into that, right?
Stole
or sent biological samples of anthrax, West Nile virus, and botulism to Iraq up until 1989, which Iraq claimed it needed for medical research. Later on, a number of these materials were found and discovered in use for Iraq's biological weapons research program, while some were used for their intended vaccine development.
You know, because there are other companies where that have been like, oh, we made a mistake. We'll still keep, you know, selling this kind of stuff. They tightened their belt so much after that.
Backups for the facility are kept at a separate facility about 60 miles west. And the areas that government contracts support, like the malaria collection.
Yes.
Doesn't that sound like a fun museum wing? Come to the ATCC and see our new malaria collection.
It is. You know, they're kept in a kind of stasis and everything for long-term storage, but they're a little bit different because
the hottest tropical diseases in the coolest environment.
Well, we have to store them in, you know, life phases, but they only live in like red blood cells. So, you know, yeah, you have to imagine that they're like, there's a little bit of like a blood bank vampire, you know, repository kind of thing. Just, you know, those like that just rows of red vials you can kind of see in your mind. It's a little creepy.
So, Santosh, walk me through this. You used to be and still do research with bacterial and viral lines. So you start parasitic lines.
Yeah.
So you decide you're going to start an experiment and you're like, all right, let me go grab my library card and go to, you know, viral Amazon and they overnight me the start of my experiment. Like, what does that cost? Who do you make the request of? How do you get that library card? What's the process here?
So, you can actually go. I'm sure. Did you log on to ATCC and actually go to the website?
They stopped answering my calls.
No. So you can go to atcc.org and I said for profit before. Technically, it's a not for profit, but you just go to atcc.org. On the upper right hand corner, there is a login and a profile and a little button that says quick order. And it shouldn't have been that tough. So I am on that website right now. And so just in the search bar, I'm going to put in TGGT1, which is a toxoplasma strain called GT1. For some reason, it does not exist. Toxoplasma GT1. There we go. So I have a strain designations here. Nicole and Monceau, ATCC 50853 product. And that says deposited as Toxoplasma gondii, Nicole and Monceau, which is the original, is it? GT1-F3, or it's called GT1. And yeah, you just click on it. The depository is Dr. Sibley, who I believe is at St. Louis, a brilliant gentleman, who's a longtime toxoplasma researcher. And they tell you it's in frozen cultures, minus 70 degrees Celsius for 1 week, or they have the freeze-dried cultures, which are 2 to 8 degrees Celsius. And then
you have a whole selection. Do you go with the artisanal or do you get the generic?
So At the very top, when you go to the website, it'll say view permits. So now, you know, it has immediately, it's got here are the permits that they have in order to keep it there, and here are the permits that you need. And so at this point, you do have to either contact a representative, or if you are like me, you know, you're at the lab, you already have an account with ATCC. So you log in using your account. This has been filled out and it has all the information about your institutions and the licenses and all this kind of stuff that you need. And you literally you punch in the order, and you usually do something called a purchase order, or you order from a grant. And it gets sent out. They always double check your permits and licenses and make sure that you're allowed to receive this. And then, yeah, you get a little, you know, little box that comes through shipping at the institution, and you're able to, you know, go up and pick it up, or they send it up to the lab and do whatever you need to do with it. Now, if you're a freelance, like if you just want to like try and order it, yes, you can make an account and create a profile, but you're going to run into kind of a hard stop if you try to just order one of these things that are potentially bioterrorism agents or BSL-2 or higher organisms. You really can't just randomly, like, you know, shop on it like it's Amazon or eBay or something like that.
Yeah, so educational episode only, folks.
I really, really, but you know, if you guys want to do science, you know, please, you know, find a, you know, good institution, you know, sign up if you're a student, anything like that, and you want to do experiments. There are other ways to get these kind of strains, which are 100% legal and they're ethical. The real issue is, though, you will have a barrier if it's anything that's pathogenic. And has any kind of potential at all for infection, which is unfortunately like the vast majority of the stuff that they have.
We'll see what other kinds of book reports come out of. Oh, I'm sorry, research, scientific research comes out of these libraries. Oh, we should get LeVar Burton to recommend it.
Yeah, but don't take my word for it. Yeah.
That man is a treasure.
He really is. I hope he gets the next the host of Jeopardy. That would be awesome.
So that's it for this week, folks. As always, we'd love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback. The show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. Our theme music is composed by Rachel Leisure. If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with links to some of the sources used in researching this episode. And until next time, as always, wash your hands, stay safe, wear a mask, get your shot. And if you've managed to do all that, it's summer, so start thinking about where you might like to go. And if you can, happy travels.
Bye, everybody.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.